Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, what to do about small arms in Iraq.
And they can be fired from anywhere, including a back of a vehicle, inside of an apartment building. And then the two people where one person fired it can just vanish.
Also, why were 94 senators no-shows for yesterday's passage of the $87 billion Iraq reconstruction bill?
And why pain medication affects different people differently?
If you take opioids, what we're talking about, narcotics, according to the prescription, you're very unlikely to get addicted. If you take them to get high, it's a totally different biochemistry.
These stories, and we take a twirl with choreographer Twyla Tharp, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. News reports from Baghdad say there are huge explosions heard in the city. Smoke can be seen from the tops of buildings. It's the second straight night of big blasts in the Iraqi capital. Further details are sketchy at this point. Spain is pulling most of its diplomatic staff out of Iraq. It's the third country to do so in the past few weeks, citing safety fears. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports from Baghdad.
Spain has been one of the United States' strongest coalition partners in its policy on Iraq. It has 1,300 troops here, but it's moving most of its embassy from Baghdad to Amman, Jordan, following the Dutch and Bulgarian embassies, which have also done so. All three embassies cited security risks. Embassies have been a prime target for those trying to thwart U.S.-led forces. The Jordanian and Turkish embassies have both been bombed in August and October, respectively. In a separate development, a roadside bomb killed a U.S. soldier in Baghdad last night. Jackie Lydon, NPR News, Baghdad.
The former CEO of medical equipment company HealthSouth has been indicted on 85 counts of fraud. Richard Scrushy is accused of creating a gigantic fraud scheme, helping him take home more than $250 million. U.S. Attorney Alice Martin says Scrushy's indictment today sends two messages.
One, that there is only one rule of law and that it applies to everyone. No one is above the law. The second message is that corporate fraud does not pay, and where it has apparently paid, we will seek disgorgement of all ill-gotten gains.
15 other HealthSouth employees have pleaded guilty to fraud. It's election day in several states. Voters are choosing candidates for a host of offices. There are two governor's mansions at stake. It's neck and neck in Mississippi between former Republican Committee Chairman Haley Barbour and Democratic Governor Ronnie Musgrove. It's a tight race for Kentucky governor candidates, but for the first time in decades, a Republican may win the contest. From member station WNKU, Marianne Zalesnik reports.
After weeks of negative ads and months of campaigning, Kentucky voters will now decide who will be their next governor. Republican Congressman Ernie Fletcher leads in the polls over Democratic Attorney General Ben Chandler. The two traveled throughout the state yesterday for last-minute campaigning, both saying the turnout would make the difference. Today's unseasonably warm temperatures could bring more voters to the polls. The White House has focused on the race, with both President Bush and Vice President Cheney campaigning for Fletcher. Chandler is blaming the congressman for problems with the national economy. Fletcher calls Chandler a state government insider. If Fletcher wins, he'll be the first Republican governor in Kentucky since 1967. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Zalesnik in Highland Heights, Kentucky.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 3 points at 98.61. Trading is moderate. The Nasdaq is down a fraction at 1,066. Trading is light. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, job losses in October were at their highest level in a year. That's according to a survey from the outplacement firm Challenger, Gray, and Christmas. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The job losses last month came pretty much across the board, according to the Chicago-based outplacement firm. For the month of October, Challenger says businesses cut nearly 172,000 jobs, a 125% increase from September. The highest number of job losses last month were in automotive, retail, and telecommunications. Regionally, Challenger says the West and the Midwest bore the heaviest job losses. The survey comes ahead of the official release later this week of the government's unemployment figures for October. It's not clear whether they'll show the same thing, since the data takes in a much broader segment of the economy. Challenger also polled human resource executives and found more than three-quarters don't expect to see a significant pickup in hiring till the second quarter of next year. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Telecommunications company Tyco says it'll cut 7,200 jobs, about 3% of its workforce. The corporation has just reported a loss for its fiscal fourth quarter. Two former Tyco executives are also on trial charged with fraud. The House of Representatives will look into charges of abuse in the mutual fund industry today. The Senate had a similar hearing yesterday, and some senators criticized the Securities and Exchange Commission for failing to protect consumers. State and regional officials complain that trading abuse is widespread in the industry. Meanwhile, the SEC's regional director in Boston is stepping down. Juan Marcelino said he is going to cut the distractions for his staff. Marcelino had headed the SEC's enforcement programs in New England. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
The NPR Shop introduces the music compilation Shake These Blues, the latest release in the I Heard It on NPR CD series at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There are reports of three or four huge explosions in central Baghdad. Eyewitnesses say smoke can be seen rising close to the compound used as the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command, the same place where several explosions were felt last night. Today's explosions add to concerns about small arms in Iraq. Defense specialists are wondering, was Sunday's downing of a Chinook helicopter, as Paul Bremer grimly put it, a lucky shot, or the first salvo in a new level of attacks? Among the munitions that are unaccounted for in Iraq are thousands of surface-to-air missiles and rocket-propelled grenades. Joining us is former Stinger missile unit leader Sean McFate. He's now at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome, Sean.
Hello.
Well, tell us about these weapons. What's the difference between them?
The difference is that a rocket-propelled grenade, or RPG, is an unguided missile, and a Stinger, or a Soviet SA-7, is a guided missile, meaning it's a fire-and-forget and it'll hit the target.
There's something on the target that attracts it?
Yes, it's a passive infrared heat-seeking warhead, which it seeks the jet engine of an aircraft.
Some of the aircraft have systems that can divert the missiles, but the U.S. military is also saying they'll change tactics to avoid the missiles. Can they?
They can do a limited number of things. I mean, in general, there's not much you can do to defend against a man pad or an RPG, because the only defense you have is somebody looking for a smoke trail from the missile, and then it gives you about 2 or 3 seconds of maneuver time. And in that 2 or 3 seconds, the only thing you can do is use flares, and hopefully that will divert the missile. Yeah. Other things they can do in Iraq is they should start flying at night so that RPG operators cannot see the helicopters.
Right. Tell us more about these weapons. Can anyone just pick one up and fire it?
Generally speaking, yes. If somebody can train them, they can pick it up in 30 minutes and be able to fire it.
But how much training can they do in a country like Iraq?
There's not much. Two things limit it. One is open space. The second one is the number of munitions they have available. They probably have a very limited number of RPGs and even more limited number of Soviet or Stinger missiles available to them. And they're not going to waste those missiles on a test fire.
Now, no one has yet been apprehended in connection with the weekend strike. Why is it so hard to catch people who use these weapons? You'd think that a few people in the neighborhood would see them.
In general, these weapons are only 5 feet tall, they weigh 30 pounds, and they can be fired from anywhere, including the back of a vehicle, inside of an apartment building, and then the two people or one person who fired it can just vanish.
Sean, what about the charge that U.S. officials could have better stockpiled and guarded these missiles?
Problems initially arose in the 80s during America's exportation of Stinger missiles to Afghanistan. And they gave them basically to the Mujahideen, and the Mujahideen took them and they basically vanished. There's no accountability for them. And we're starting to see some of those missiles appear in Pakistan and Sri Lanka and so forth.
Are we seeing them in Iraq?
We don't know. I mean, there's persistent rumors that Al-Qaeda has them, but that's not been verified. In Iraq, what we're seeing are unguided RPGs.
Do you share the fear of terrorism researchers that this attack in Iraq has the earmarks of Arab and Afghan units in Chechnya, and that means that there is more foreign involvement in Iraq insurgents than the U.S. thought?
Yes, I share that fear on many different levels. Certainly, there is a theory that most of the military activities going on is from foreign, not Iraqi units operating inside of Iraq. However, the downing of the Chinook helicopter doesn't necessarily mean that that was done by a Chechenian person. That was done by somebody who could wield an RPG, which could easily have been an Iraqi soldier as well, because they certainly do stop RPGs in the Iraqi army.
Yeah. And the fact that they did down it after what we now know are several failed attempts, what do you expect to happen?
I think it's going to do a couple things. First of all, it's going to embolden the morale of the Iraqi resistance. And second of all, the U.S. military is going to reconsider how it does operations. If they indeed have to fly most of their aircraft missions at nighttime and with an Apache gunship helicopter escort, that's going to severely restrict how they do business in Iraq.
Well, Sean, thank you.
Thank you.
Sean McFade, a former Stinger missile unit leader. He joined us from the Kennedy School of Government in Boston. Well, at 5 p.m. yesterday, the Senate voted to approve the $87.5 billion package for war costs in Iraq and Afghanistan. Or did it? The package was passed by a procedure called a voice vote, but there were only six senators in the chamber, and only one of them called out yay or nay. He chose nay. So history books will never say who voted for and who against the controversial funding package. We're joined from Washington by Norman Ornstein. He's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And Norman, how exactly does a voice vote work?
In Congress, in both houses, an awful lot is done by voice vote because, especially in the Senate, if you did a roll call vote to everything, hundreds and hundreds of votes on amendments and bills, you'd be able to do nothing else. So routine matters are regularly done this way. Usually something that has any controversy or importance attached to it will come to a roll call when you get a small number of members to demand it.
So now let me stop you there. Only six senators were there when this vote was taken, so nobody's voice was heard, and there was no roll call taken in the way that we picture it, you know, that a name is called out and somebody responds. So how can it be called a voice vote if no one's there?
How can a tree fall in the forest if nobody hears it? It's an interesting philosophical question, but of course, the reality is that unless somebody objects to taking a vote at that particular moment on the floor, you can have a vote on something.
Well, now, wait a minute. Senator Robert Byrd did shout out nay. Doesn't that force a different kind of vote?
No. Senator Byrd didn't say, I object because of the absence of a quorum. Nobody did, and basically, you almost could say the fix was in. They decided, after having gone through the controversy on this issue of the $87 billion, Having voted on the Senate floor once before, where there was enough of a rebellion among Republicans that they actually insisted on having $10 billion of this money be in the form of loans, having voted on a conference report that had come through that when it came to this final vote, where in effect they were giving up their position that they'd taken before for loans, caving in to what the administration wanted, neither side particularly wanted to be called to account for a vote and then have to go back home and explain it to constituents.
So there is no record of who voted yay or who voted nay, except for, of course, Senator Robert Byrd, who shouted out nay. There's no record of what a senator voted on this important legislation.
There is no record of how they voted on final passage of this legislation. Senator Byrd, who feels strongly about this issue, was perfectly happy to be recorded against, but also didn't want to be the skunk at the garden party for the rest of his colleagues in this case, and knew it was a lost cause.
In other words, that's why he didn't force the vote.
Yes. He could have forced all the members to come back into the chamber, or at least half of them, and deal with a procedure where he would have demanded a roll call, but it would have taken a sizable number of people on the floor to go along with him. So he would have failed. And he wasn't going to be Don Quixote in this case.
Right. And just one last question, Norman. How usual or unusual is it for something as important as this legislation to be passed in its final form in this way?
Voice votes on major legislation, sweeping legislation, really important legislation, almost never happen. This is a rare occurrence.
Do you see it as a shirking of responsibility by the Senate?
Yes, it's a shirking of responsibility by the Senate. It's individual senators making a calculation, knowing that the outcome was a foregone conclusion, and deciding basically to try and have it both ways. And, you know, they shouldn't be doing that.
Norman Ornstein, thank you.
Sure.
Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute.
Getting a gun through security on Capitol Hill. It happened last week. It was a toy gun, fortunately, part of a couple of congressional staffers' Halloween revelries. But the incidents now led the Capitol Hill police to plan a new emergency communications post. To learn why and how well it's working, we're joined now by Jennifer Yaknin of the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call. Welcome, Jennifer.
Hi.
Jennifer, first, just review briefly for us what happened.
Well, Thursday afternoon, the day before Halloween, there were two Hill staffers from Representative Shimkus's office who had a Halloween costume and passed through a security checkpoint in the Cannon House office building. An officer on post there failed to notice the image of the gun on the screen that shows the X-rays until the staffers had left the area.
So what they looked at, they look at kind of an after image. Why didn't they capture it right away?
Apparently, according to Capitol Police officials, the officer was distracted by another visitor who was asking her for directions.
Oh, I see.
And so she didn't immediately notice the image.
Now, a system was supposed to kick in right away, right, that would have alerted the 140-some-odd members of Congress in the Cannon office building that there was a problem.
That's correct. Following September 11th, there was a system, an intercom system known as the Annunciator, that was installed throughout the office buildings here on the Capitol campus. And it's supposed to be used in emergencies to give information to offices about what's going on, as well as an email system that members, an email device, a BlackBerry, members carry with them. Apparently, according to the chairman of the House Administration Committee, he requested that a message go out on those systems, and it failed to do so for about 40 minutes.
So what are the Capitol Hill police going to do about all this now? What changes are they going to make?
Well, beginning yesterday, the police have changed the way that they screen visitors and staff that are coming into the office buildings. They've essentially slowed down what they're doing by having visitors and staff wait for their items to go through an X-ray machine before they themselves are allowed to pass through a metal detector.
Jennifer, that seems kind of basic, not to let people kind of push through before they've actually been able to see what they may have on them. I guess the idea is they needed to keep things moving, and now things might move a little slower?
Exactly. What they've said, the Senate Sergeant at Arms, which oversees security for the Senate office buildings, has said that they simply enhanced the system they already had in place.
Now, what about this new emergency communications post?
The new emergency communications post is a temporary position. There's not one officer who's assigned to that at all times, but the Capitol Police created that, they've said, to have somebody who's focused on the emergency communications, somebody whose sole job is to make sure that the Annunciator message or the email message goes out in case of an emergency.
Jennifer, there was already another incident in and around the Cannon House office building. Was there not? And the system's already been tested.
Yeah, a man allegedly threw a brick. He broke a window in the building and was subsequently arrested.
And this new communications post already kicked in?
The incident happened around noon, and I believe it was 12:24 was when the message went out to offices, giving them information about what had happened.
Still using that Annunciator system in the BlackBerries, but just better coordinated?
That's the idea, that the person in the emergency communications post now ensures that a message is going out over those systems.
Just to finish up, Jennifer, have you taken the temperature of members of Congress in that office building? Some of them still may be upset that after all that's happened in this country and all the concern about security, something like this could have happened.
The incident certainly raised concern among members. Many were simply concerned that the communication system didn't seem to work as it was supposed to. There are now investigations being done into the incident. They haven't said specifically whether or not officers will be sanctioned that were involved in the incident.
Jennifer Yaknin writes for the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call. She joined us from Washington. Thanks very much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Just ahead, what part of Do Not Call do you not understand? AT&T is threatened with fines for calling people on the Don't Call list.
And later in the show, Maine voters weigh in on a casino. Supporters say it'll mean jobs. Opponents say it'll tarnish Maine's image.
There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
It's been a month now since the national Do Not Call list created telemarketing free zones in homes across America. But it seems some on the list have been yanked out of their comfy chairs anyway to answer the phone from people they'd rather not hear from. Joining us on the line from Washington to explain is Federal Communications Commission Enforcement Bureau Chief David Solomon. Welcome, Mr. Solomon.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. So your boss, FCC Chairman Michael Powell, is considering fines against AT&T, right? Why is that?
That's correct. This involves the commission's company-specific Do Not Call list. These are rules that have been in effect prior to the national Do Not Call list. And basically, our investigation found that AT&T appears to have contacted 29 different customers on 78 occasions when they'd specifically asked AT&T not to receive telemarketing calls from them. So what the commission did was propose this fine, and it certainly indicates that the commission has heard from consumers that they don't want these kinds of unwanted and unwarranted intrusions into their homes, and that the commission is taking enforcement seriously in this area.
Taking enforcement seriously, this fine is serious business, isn't it? What could they be fined?
They could be fined up to $780,000 in the action that the commission announced yesterday.
That's because of the 78 calls, each one would be fined $10,000, huh?
That's right. The idea basically is we're looking at each call as a separate violation for $10,000 each for a total of $780,000.
Now, Mr. Solomon, how did you find out that AT&T allegedly, I guess we need to say, made these calls?
Well, the key is that we listen to consumers and we track carefully the consumer complaints that we receive here at the FCC, and we saw a number of them from AT&T over a period of time, and so we started an investigation, contacted AT&T, checked our facts, and then went forward with this proposed fine.
What's AT&T said about all this? They have 30 days to reply, I understand.
Well, I'll leave it to AT&T. They do have 30 days to respond, and the commission will look carefully at their response and decide whether to impose the full fine at that point.
Now, are you seeing any other companies allegedly violating the Do Not Call list?
Well, I'm not going to get into specific investigations, but I can tell you we're looking into several pending matters, and certainly if we find violations of our company-specific rules or the national Do Not Call rules that recently went into effect, we will respond with strong and swift enforcement action.
In any event, the FCC is taking this Do Not Call list very seriously.
That's correct. Consumers have made clear that this is an important priority to them, and it's our top consumer protection enforcement priority. And if there are serious violations out there, we will take action.
David Solomon is Enforcement Bureau Chief for the FCC, and he joined us on the line from Washington. Thanks a lot, Mr. Solomon.
Thank you.
The powerful prescription pain medication OxyContin has been called white trash heroin by some because of its addictive nature. Syndicated talk show host Rush Limbaugh admitted last month on air to being addicted to painkillers. The abuse of narcotics is deeply stigmatized in our society, so much so that it may prevent patients with chronic pain from getting adequate treatment. So says Judy Foreman. She's Here Now's regular health columnist, and she joins us now. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Boy, Rush Limbaugh's announcement did have a lot of reverberations, didn't it?
It certainly did. It's sort of both good news and bad news for the people who are trying to get pain front and center. I mean, he's kind of the bad boy example of how addiction to painkillers by abusers really makes life tough for people who legitimately need the drugs.
Right. And one of the side effects of that is that they are not getting treated. You quote someone in your column as saying that every bit of evidence suggests that we have been under-treating pain. I'm picturing people lying on gurneys crying out. I mean, what does that statement mean?
Partly what you said, yes, crying in hospitals, but also at home. I think a lot of the pain is sort of hidden behind closed doors. It's people with cancer. It's people with arthritis. There's apparently between 50 and 75 million Americans who live their lives in chronic pain, and they are afraid of getting addicted, and doctors are afraid of A, getting their patients addicted, and B, getting in trouble with the Drug Enforcement Administration. So everybody's afraid of these drugs, but they shouldn't be.
Because, in fact, you found out what?
That if you take opioids, what we're talking about, narcotics, according to the prescription and the dosing that your doctor sets, you're very, very, very unlikely to get addicted. If you take them to get high, as I presume, but I don't know, Rush Limbaugh did, it's a totally different biochemistry. And the reason is if you take them sort of as prescribed, you end up with a steady state of the narcotics in your system. You don't go up and down. If you take them to get high, you'd probably take more of them than you should in the first place. And then as the drug wears off, you go into withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And it's the unpleasant sensations of withdrawal that make you want to take the drug again. So you're on a constant seesaw.
So it seems as if the war on cancer pain has sort of collided with the war on drugs.
That's absolutely right. And it's really a shame because I think we're getting somewhere in this country in terms of trying to make death and dying a little more humane with the hospice movement and everything. But a lot of that depends on adequate pain control. So the people, the neurologists, the pain specialists, of whom there's a growing number, are trying to get past this psychological barrier that pain meds are automatically addictive.
You give some examples as to why you think pain management hasn't been addressed. In a 2000-2001 survey of medical schools, only 3% had a separate course on pain management?
Separate required course,
yeah.
They have since done a new survey asking the question slightly differently, and the medical schools come out a little bit better. But it's still, most doctors don't really know how to treat pain aggressively and, you know, making that balance for keeping people lucid and having their pain controlled. In fact, one of these studies that I talk about in the article found that 50% of people die in pain, and children as well. We're even more skittish about treating children's pain.
A terrible statistic. But is there any good news coming out of research into pain?
Yes, actually, there's quite a lot. There's new drugs coming out, and there are new ways of delivering old drugs, and there's a new sense that people's pain should be treated aggressively, especially in hospitals. There's a new rule from the organization that accredits hospitals saying that every patient deserves a pain assessment, and if that pain isn't treated adequately, the hospital can stand to lose its accreditation. Mm-hmm. So patients have more force behind their demands for pain meds.
Judy, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Here and Now's regular health columnist Judy Foreman. To read her latest, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, post-election day results from three key governor's races with implications for President Bush's popularity.
And David McCauley of How Things Work fame builds a mosque in his new book. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, budget troubles, high unemployment. Voters in Maine consider gambling in a casino as a solution.
It's estimated that maybe 5,000 jobs would come directly from the casino and another 5,000 from indirect employment around it. The opponents say that these jobs come at too high a social cost.
And creativity, according to Twyla Tharp.
You must carve away, we all must carve away, those things that comfort us in some regard and do not allow us the time to do what we need to do or the focus.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Four large explosions shook central Baghdad today. Officials say two mortars landed inside the compound used as headquarters of U.S. occupation forces. Smoke could be seen rising from the northern end of the compound near the Tigris River. This is the second straight night of major explosions in the center of the Iraqi capital. Increasing the number of U.S. troops is not the way to stop the attacks in Iraq. That's according to a group of Republican lawmakers just back from there. Thelma LeBrec reports.
Some Democrats continue to insist the quickest way to stop attacks is to increase the number of American forces in Iraq, since international forces aren't coming and it will take time to train Iraqis. California Republican Ed Royce says that was topic A in meetings with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
We've got quite an animated discussion about additional steps that can be taken over the short term.
He and other Republicans share Rumsfeld's view that training for Iraqis should be accelerated, intelligence and technology should be improved, and more must be done to seal Iraq's borders with Syria and Iran. Thelma LeBrec at the Pentagon.
President Bush is touring scorched areas of California by foot and air. Both Governor Gray Davis and Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger are joining the president. The president is also expected to meet with firefighters who battled the flames that swept across more than 743,000 acres, causing more than 20 deaths and destroying over 3,500 homes. The former CEO of the medical care company HealthSouth has been indicted in a federal fraud case. Richard Scrushy is accused of a range of criminal violations, including securities fraud and false certification of corporate statements designed to pump up the company's stock prices. 15 former executives of the rehabilitation services company have already pleaded guilty in the case. The world's largest retailer, Walmart, says it has received a target letter from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Pennsylvania, notifying it of a federal grand jury investigation over immigration. The announcement comes on the heels of last month's sweep of Walmart stores in 21 states where hundreds of illegal immigrants were arrested. The workers were employed by cleaning companies hired by Walmart. The grand jury reportedly will look at whether the retailer violated immigration laws through its connection with the contractors. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. The Dow is up a fraction at 98.58. The Nasdaq is down a point at 19.66.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Maine's motto on highway signs all over the state is Maine, the way life should be. But should life in Maine include casino gambling? Mainers vote on that today, and joining me on the line to discuss it is Maine public broadcasting reporter Charlotte Renner. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Charlotte, thanks for joining us. We're talking about a $650 million resort and casino in southern Maine here. Why do some people want such a thing in Maine?
Well, the people who want such a thing, among others, are two Indian tribes here in Maine, the Penobscots and the Passamaquoddies. These are tribes who did get some money in about 1980, a land claim settlement of about $80 million. But a lot of that money is gone. It's either been invested without much return, or it's been spent on things they needed, like new housing. Mm-hmm. And so they see this as a way of building capital sort of anew. It's important to notice, though, that they're not putting this casino on their own tribal land, which is in northeastern Maine, mm-hmm. because they say that would be too far from the Boston and New York markets. So they're trying to put it in southern Maine, and that's where some of the controversy comes in.
Now, there are some besides the Native Americans who are for it, even though it's in southern Maine, just about an hour and a half, 2 hours or so from Boston.
Sure, because the supporters of this proposal have actually downplayed the benefits to the Indians during this campaign, and they have tried to make this a campaign about jobs for everyone. It's estimated that maybe 5,000 jobs would come directly from the casino and another 5,000 from indirect employment around it. The state of Maine would also get some money, maybe as much as $1 million a year. That's about 25% of the slot revenues. So the people who want this thing say, look, this is a good deal for Maine. It brings us jobs. You know, there are 30 others, I think, or 29 others that Indian tribes are operating across the country. Why shouldn't Maine get a piece of that action? That's their argument.
Yeah. Now, the Maine economy is somewhat troubled.
Right.
So what would the downside be then, Charlotte, to a casino that provides jobs in a Maine economy that, like so many economies in so many states, is troubled?
Well, the opponents, and they include the governor of the state and his predecessor, say that these jobs come at too high a social cost. Mm. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. They point to, for example, Ledyard, Connecticut, which is the home of Foxwoods, the world's largest casino, and nearby Mohegan Sun. They look down there and they see new congestion down there. They see more crime. They see more addiction to gambling. And the people in Ledyard are actually warning Maine not to do it.
And there's also kind of an aesthetic or an image question here, isn't there? Maine, home of L.L. Bean, it's kind of got a Christmas card issue, forests and beautiful coastline. That's why people like the chairman of L.L. Bean, for example, are pouring money into the fight against this casino.
That's a big reason. It's what advertisers call branding, and they think that Maine has a brand in the tourist industry. If you look at the front of an L.L. Bean catalog, you see canoes and you see beautiful mountains and trees and water. You don't see slot machines.
Yeah.
So that's one of their concerns. They're not the only ones, by the way, who are fighting this with big money. The credit card giant MBNA is also putting some money into this. And I think that it's the most expensive political campaign in the state's history.
Hmm. So I guess the final question, what's the betting line on how it's all going to turn out?
You know, even if I were a betting person, I wouldn't bet on this.
Mm.
Mainers are very independent, and sometimes they would reject something like this just because they don't like the idea of all the out-of-state big money in the campaign. Most of the supporters are getting their money for this campaign from the casino developer in Las Vegas. That may turn some voters off. On the other hand, a political science professor from University of Southern Maine said to me, you know, at this kind of time when the economy is so weak, that whole branding argument, you know, the way life should be, could be trumped by people's need for the work.
Maine Public Broadcasting reporter Charlotte Renner joined us from Portland, Maine. Thanks, Charlotte.
You're welcome.
Well, according to a national study, people who live within 50 miles of a casino are twice as likely to be addicted to gambling than people at a greater distance. Gambling addiction, that's one of the concerns of the anti-casino crowd. And now researchers are exploring ways of treating gambling as an addiction, including prescribing a pill also used to curb alcohol addiction. Joining us on the line is Dr. Mark Potenza. He's director of the Problem Gambling Clinic at Yale University. Hello, doctor.
Hello.
Wow, a pill you could pop to stop compulsive gambling. It sounds too good to be true.
It might be too good to be true. I think that medications are one line of treatment, and behavioral therapies are also going to be very important.
Well, this is part of a switch in thinking about gambling, isn't it? It was once seen, if seen negatively, as a moral failure. Is it now seen as an illness?
I think it's moving more towards that view. I believe that as we get a better understanding of the biology that drives behaviors like gambling and excessive forms of gambling, that it will be considered more of a medical or psychiatric disorder.
Well, tell us a little bit about this pill that may or may not work. In layman's terms, how would it work?
It blocks receptors in the brain, particularly those that respond to endorphins naturally or to drugs like heroin or morphine.
It blocks cravings.
It blocks specific receptors in the brain that influence brain systems that seem to underlie cravings.
Mm. It's called naltrexone, do I have that right?
Correct.
But some of your colleagues are suggesting that gambling might be a sign of another underlying problem, such as depression, and that perhaps if the depression were treated first with maybe another pill, that might curb gambling.
People with gambling problems often have co-occurring mental health disorders, including depression. Mm. However, the studies that have been performed to date suggest that medications such as naltrexone and perhaps other medications seem to work independently of these other co-occurring conditions.
Well, are you saying that some gamblers might be genetically predisposed to gamble?
There are data to suggest that there are significant genetic and environmental contributions that are involved in having a risk to develop problem pathological gambling.
So if somebody thinks they have a problem, you know, they're in debt, you know, it's looking bad, in addition to perhaps maybe seeking out a doctor's help with pills, what do you suggest they do?
I think it's important to seek appropriate help, which often involves counseling.
How do support groups, you know, in the AA model, how do they work for gamblers?
Data suggests that they work as well as support groups for other addictions. Mm. And what I instruct people who I'm treating is that this requires work throughout the rest of one's life, meaning it's a day-by-day piece of work.
And given our opening statistic, you know, that people who live closer to casinos are more likely to be addicted, should compulsive gamblers take a first step and move?
Legalized gambling availability is becoming great throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for people to, with gambling problems, to learn how to cope with triggers to gamble,
right,
including being around legalized forms of gambling.
Well, doctor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Psychiatrist Mark Potenza is director of Yale University's Problem Gambling Clinic.
Still to come, choreographer Twyla Tharp on creativity and finding time to create.
You're listening to Here and Now. 70 million U.S. citizens are between the ages of 18 and 35. Tonight, CNN will try to rock that young vote. Russell Simmons is trying to hip-hop it. In the 70s, Simmons helped sell hip-hop to the world as manager of his brother's band, Run DMC, then co-founder of his own record label, Def Jam. He's also chair of the Hip Hop Summit Action Network, which invites stars to cities like Philadelphia to register voters. And Russell Simmons is on the line. Hello.
Hi.
Well, causes are not new to you. But why this cause? Why voting?
Well, the most American thing you can do is vote. You know, I think that it empowers you. Young people are apathetic for the most part, and many feel locked out of the process. And when you vote, you feel like you're part of the process. When you remind a young person that his vote is as powerful as Bill Gates' vote, you know, it's the beginning of a discussion that they have to have with themselves about their futures, about their connection to community.
Do they have that reaction, though? Because a lot of parents listening might say, well, what I get is a glazed look back. Because, you know, you're running up against some research that shows that young people don't have an attachment to their communities that older people do, if, you know, that own property. They move around a lot more. They don't pay taxes. So they're not feeling as connected.
Yeah, but if we can get 15 or 20% more votes. We plan of WWE and Hip Hop Summit said we're going to get 2 million more in 2004.
Now, is this the World Wrestling?
That's correct.
This is the SmackDown vote, right?
That's correct. So we're partners to get, and we're working. We've been working all over the country with the Hip Hop Summit Action Network on our own. We had a summit with Mayor Street, and we registered, according to Governor Randall, 80,000 voters.
In Pennsylvania?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And 11,000 voters went to new voters registered in the, where we told them to go and register just to get to that one event. You know, it, when you get young, Will Smith and Damon Dash and Wyclef and LL Cool J and others came to that hip-hop summit in Philadelphia. So we had 11,000 people who registered for per ticket. Now, what we got to do, I believe, if you want young people to be connected, we have to remind them that that's not only their right, but that's what's in style.
When you talk to kids, and especially maybe an inner-city kid, an urban kid, what kinds of issues are they talking about?
Well, you have to talk about the fact that they're at war and that they should be – the real war is the war on poverty and ignorance. That's the war that I'd like to see this country address. We always put our resources in, you know, $87 billion going in to fight a war in Iraq, but $87 billion would do a – great service fighting the war on poverty and ignorance.
So you're lining up young people to vote and might get that 2 million. Are you telling them how to vote?
Well, not in the same breath. I think young people are compassionate and have higher aspirations for America. And I love the fact that hip-hop has brought people together in a way that they have not been together. I see a mix of all kinds of people, and they all speak in the same language. And I know that Eminem and 50 Cent are one and the same. And the difference between the trailer park and the projects is minimal. The common thread of poverty is recognized by the young, where the adults did not recognize the common thread as being as strong as it is. And I think that that's going to be the future.
Russell Simmons, that's all the time we have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Russell Simmons, chair of the Hip Hop Summit Action Network.
With us, there's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The mystery of creativity. There's no instruction manual for it. In fact, a lot of us tend to think art is ignited by a thunderbolt from above. Inspiration that's only the province of an elect blessed with the gift for communing with the muse. But that's not how renowned choreographer Twyla Tharp sees it in her new book, The Creative Habit. She believes in inspiration, but she also suggests most anyone can unleash creativity. The secret for even the wildest flights of creative abandon, she writes, is of all things simply establishing a routine. I recently spoke with Twyla Tharp, perhaps the preeminent choreographer of her American generation, not about her career in dance, but about her book. I asked her to give advice on getting started to an imaginary, very busy mother of three who has a dream. She wants to write a novel, or compose a poem, or a piece of music, or choreograph a dance.
Oi, how old are the kids?
Well, the kids are young. Kids
how
are three,
young?
5, and 7.
3, 5, and 7. Okay, this is barely manageable.
Barely manageable.
Let's say novel.
Novel.
All right. Let's say that the first thing she's going to have to do, 3, 5, and 7. Okay, 5 and 7 are kind of parked during the day. 3, she's got to find a way of parking. Okay. Hopefully there's some kind of nursery school. In other words, what I'm saying here is she has to clear some time for herself. And that is the first hurdle because as a mom of three, she's been thinking about three children. And the novel, she may be able to pull the three children into it, which I'm sure she will. But she has to create a space for the novel to become her fourth child.
Doesn't have to be necessarily, given our imaginary situation, a whole lot of space, even.
It need not be a whole lot, but it need be consistent. And it best would be at the same time, and it best would be earliest as possible in the day, because there will be a disaster during the course of that day.
But
and
Twyla,
hopefully she's gotten it in before disaster.
Right. Spoken like a mother.
But
Twyla, I thought art was all about inspiration, that thunderbolt from above that we alluded to.
Right. That's nice. And if you have a great deal of faith and pray very hard, you may, on occasion, become lucky. But otherwise, it's up to you. And that's why I call this book The Creative Habit, because I don't naysay the fact that we all need larger forces than what we can muster. But we have a responsibility to bring to the table all we possibly can. And that's where habit comes in. And good format, not of the sort where it becomes boring, tedious routine, but of the sort that is supportive, where one chooses to use it or not, but is always referring to it.
Good work habits.
Good work habits.
Well, along with good work habits, you also sort of debunk the idea of a natural genius. One thinks of Picasso. One thinks of Bob Dylan. The preeminent example may be Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, whose music just seemed to flood out of him effortlessly.
Mozart is someone I refer to often in this book. He's one of my very favorites. I know him quite well. I also know his father quite well. And Mozart, no doubt, was genetically inclined to becoming a musician. But without his father's guidance and his father's tutelage from the time he was 2 years old, Mozart would never have been the composer that he became. And this education, which was courses in all kinds of humanities, as well as musical composition, included as well the fact that, hello, Wolfgang, get up there and practice your music.
What's creative DNA?
Creative DNA is the aptitude that we all have to be larger than we are at the moment, to discover things, to challenge ourselves. And we all have it in a different format. Some have it very clearly visually, some have it very clearly orally or physically, and some are philosophers. But everyone has an inclination and an aptitude. Everyone has a gift. Everyone has a genius used very broadly. And if we're lucky and we work hard, we can find it. We can find it for our children, and we can set ourselves and our children on that path.
That's so much what The Creative Habit is about. What it's not about, it's not a how-to book. It's not a motivational book. It's not a you-can-do-it book, necessarily. It's more like a you can do it, but you need to do it and then kind of shut up about it kind of book.
I like that. It's a can-do book, but shut up first. We call it on the cover a practical guide, and I do try to be very practical within it and very tangible. There are concrete exercises to be used. I was speaking with a wonderful woman today, Barbara Neely, who is a writer, and she told me that she had read the book and she got to the exercise called Do a Verb. She's stuck in her book, and she's going, oh, do a verb, pick a verb, and she's going, grope. And she starts groping, and she says, yes, that's what I'm doing here. I'm groping. And she got through her problem in the book. I said, well, did you do good grope? Did you get on the floor? Was it on all fours? She said, no, I didn't get that far. I said, you have more groping to do, but I'm pleased you got through your problem in the book.
Groping.
That's practical.
The book is full of exercises. It's full of ways to sort of spark something. Tell me about these creative diets that are in the book. For example, not looking in the mirror, not looking at the watch.
The distractions, the having to give up part, you would have to settle in on that, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
yes.
Back to that nasty discipline part.
Yes, paring away, getting rid of distractions. Fear is of various sorts, is one of the very first topics in this book. And I think that one of the first impediments, roadblocks we put in our way as creative thinkers or people is fear, and that's a good one. Fear is a big distraction. In order to grapple with it, it's good to get rid of other distractions. So, for example, Randy Newman. I don't know Randy Newman well, but Randy Newman is a composer and a pianist, and he hates composing. He's very good, but he hates doing it because it's very painful for him. So what does he do? He takes up classical piano, so he'll have to practice so many hours a day. He does not have time to compose music. We might call that brilliant distraction. Okay. You must carve away. We all must carve away those things that comfort us in some regard and do not allow us the time to do what we need to do or the focus.
Even Twyla Tharp, master choreographer, pretty deep into her career not so long ago, starts a musical based on the songs of Billy Joel, goes out to Chicago, and failure.
Oh, so tragic, so sad, so true, yes.
Moving Out, of course, is what we're talking about, which
right.
is now on Broadway. But tell us about how that got to Broadway. It wasn't easy.
First, there were 2 years of work and a $10 million investment, and we were in Chicago, and we opened to pretty rotten opening night press. No surprise here. I knew that the show wasn't working, but I could have been devastated by the press. It would not have been difficult. But instead, I realized I had two courses of action. One is I could say, screw you all, you're wrong. Or I could say, okay, they're right, fix it, because you know they're right and it's not working. Or they wouldn't be able to say this. And I said, right, okay, so what am I going to do? So I took hold of it and I rewrote the first act in 3 weeks.
Twyla, why did you write a book kind of for every man or woman about creativity as opposed to a book about how to choreograph?
I think that artists have curiosity. I think that thinking people have curiosity. I wanted to see if the lessons that I learned were good for anybody else, which I think they are. I use a word in here often called transactional is the word, that lessons learned in one place can be applied to thousands of other places by thousands of other people. And I'm reconfirmed by the idea of community.
If you were to distill, then, the creative habit to its essence, what are you trying to say?
For me, that every one of us has the opportunity to discover a little more in any given day if we're prepared to do so and if we expect it of ourselves. And that's a good thing, whether you're working hard on a business deal or you have a child who is recalcitrant and you'd like to be able to guide them a little better. It's about making a discovery every day.
Twyla Tharp, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Twyla Tharp, choreographer, is author of The Creative Habit, Learn It and Use It for Life.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tomagawa, Brad Fritz, Jordana Gustafson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Strapatsky. Our web producer is Zach Christo. Our interns are Ed Walters and Ann Stevenson.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
Republicans smell opportunity in the South as Democratic senators from Georgia and Florida retire.
And David McCauley of The Way Things Work fame builds a mosque in his new book.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.